Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gopinath Shyamakunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai Navadvipa Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai Bhakti Devi Ki Jai Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Gaur Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
It's July 31st, 2019 in Zagreb, Croatia. We're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 17, Punishment and Reward of Kali. And we're reading perhaps one of the most difficult, mysterious, and challenging verses in the Bhagavatam, text 22. Rajavacha. Yeah? Dharmam bravisi dharmagna.
Dharmam bravisi dharmagna.
Dharmosi visharupa duk.
Dharmosi visharupa duk.
Yada dharma kritastanam.
Yada dharma kritastanam.
Sucha kasya pitad bhavet. Raja Uvacha. The king said, Dharmam, religion, Bhavishi, as you speak, Dharmagna, or one who knows the codes of religion, Dharmaha, the personality of religion, Asi, you are, Vrisha Rupa Vrik. In the disguise of a bull.
In the disguise of a bull.
Yet, whatever.
A dharma krita.
One who acts irreligiously. Stanam. Place. Sukha kasya. Of the identifier. Api.
Also.
Tat. That. Bhavet. Becomes. The king said, O you who are in the form of a bull, you know the truth of religion, and you are speaking according to the principle that the destination intended for the perpetrator of irreligious acts is also intended for one who identifies the perpetrator. You are no other than the personality of religion. Purport. A devotee's conclusion is that no one is directly responsible for being a benefactor or mischief monger without the sanction of the Lord. Therefore, he does not consider anyone to be directly responsible for such action. But in both the cases, he takes it for granted that either benefit or loss is God-sent. But in the case of loss or reverses, one becomes doubtful. Oh, sorry. I skipped something, sorry. Okay, I'll read that again. But in both the cases, he takes it for granted that either benefit or loss is God-sent, and thus it is his grace. In the case of benefit, no one will deny that it is God-sent. But in the case of loss or reverses, one becomes doubtful about how the Lord could be so unkind to his devotee as to put him in great difficulty. Jesus Christ was seemingly put into such great difficulty, being crucified by the ignorant, but he was never angry at the mischief-mongers. That is the way of accepting a thing, either favorable or unfavorable. Thus, for a devotee, the identifier is equally a sinner, like the mischief monger. What a statement. The identifier is equally a sinner, like the mischief monger. By God's grace, the devotee tolerates all reverses. Maharaj Prakrit observed this, and therefore he can understand that the bull was no other than the personality of religion himself. In other words, a devotee has no suffering at all, because so-called suffering is also God's grace for a devotee who sees God in everything. The cow and bull never placed any complaint before the king for being tortured by the personality of Godhead, although everyone lodges such complaints before the state authorities. The extraordinary behavior of the bull made the king conclude that the bull was certainly the personality of religion, for no one else could understand the finer intricacies of the codes of religion. Rajavacha dharmam bravisi dharmagna dharma si vrishalupadrik yad adharma kritastanam sucha kasya pitadbhavet. The king said, O you, who are in the form of a bull, you know the truth of religion, and you are speaking according to the principle that the destination intended for the perpetrator of irreligious acts is also intended for one who identifies the perpetrator. You are no other than the personality of religion. This verse doesn't seem to make the slightest bit of logical sense. Someone does something wrong, and the person who says, he's the one, she's the one, who did something wrong, goes to the same place as the person who did something wrong. That make any sense to anybody at all? It does?
Yes.
Oh, good. Well, we'll ask you pretty soon how it makes sense to you. And Prabhupada says here in the purport, for a devotee, the identifier is equally a sinner like the mischief monk. If somebody hits you and you say, he hit me, you go to the same place. And you're equally sinful. Ah! That sounds crazy. It doesn't sound like you could run a society that way. And it just doesn't even seem logical. Now in text 28, Maharaj Bricket picks up his sword and is about to kill Kali, the perpetrator. And in order to kill him, he would have to identify him. And in fact, this whole conversation starts because Maharaj Bricket says to the bull and the cow, who did this to you? He asks them to identify the perpetrator. And this is text 22. In text 28, just six sentences later, whatever, he himself identifies the perpetrator and is ready to kill him. So what in the world does this verse mean? And we're going to look at this on two levels. One is the level of the soul, and the other is the level of varna. Varna dharma. And these two levels need to be seen separately. As Srila Prabhupada writes in his purport to Bhagavad Gita 9:30, Apichet Sucharacharo, that generally a person's external duties are running parallel to one's spiritual duties, but sometimes there's a conflict. Sometimes the way we would like to act as a devotee is different from the way that we need to act as far as our duties in the world. And of course, this problem was experienced by Arjuna, that as a devotee, he did not want to identify the perpetrator. As a devotee, he wanted to forgive everybody on the other side and walk away and not fight them, even though they had done so many things to him. You know, the list of evil done by the Kurus to the Pandavas was a long list, starting in childhood, where Duryodhan poisoned Bhima, going to where the house of Lak was set on fire. So there was an attempt to murder Bhima, to murder all five Pandavas and Kunti. Then the gambling match to cheat them out of their kingdom, the attempted disrobing of Draupadi, at which time Bhishma and Drona were silent, and then the refusal to give the Pandavas even a speck of land for their livelihood, and others as well. But even then, Arjuna did not want to identify them as the perpetrators. He did not want to say These people are guilty. He said, they may be greedy, they may be avaricious, but we're not going to fight with them. I'm not interested in fighting with them. And Srila Prabhupada says that this attitude of Arjuna was due to his soft-hearted and compassionate nature as a devotee. And in fact, we will see Maharaj Parikit himself. When does Maharaj Parikit not identify the perpetrator? Here he does. He's going to say, hey, you, Kali, are the perpetrator. Later on, when does he not, in his own life, yes?
At the end of the life, when this boy just made a curse, he could act on the different ways.
Yes.
He just went to the...
Exactly. When Maharaj Parikit himself was cursed by Sringi, he could have countered that curse. But he didn't. He did not, in that case, identify the perpetrator. He did not blame Sringi. He did not blame Shamaka Rishi. If anything, he blamed himself. But he certainly didn't blame God. Here Prabhupada said in the purport, the devotee sees everything is coming from God and everything's good. Everything is grace. And he says when we get a good thing, you know, we get money, we get a nice house, we get a nice spouse, we get a healthy child, oh, this is Krishna's mercy on me. And when we lose our money, our spouse leaves us, our child dies or doesn't become a good child, then how is this Krishna's mercy? But the devotee sees everything. If someone's acting as my friend, that's Krishna's mercy. If someone's acting as my enemy, that's Krishna's mercy. They see everything as Krishna's mercy. And in fact, that attitude of the devotee is a lot of what makes the devotee dear to the Lord. Being equal to friends and enemies, happiness and distress, honor and dishonor, fame and infamy, success and failure. Krishna says this in the Bhagavad Gita many times. This equilibrium of the devotee. This samadarshinaha. Not just vijaya vinaya sampane brahmani gavi hastami suni chai vasu pakita pandita samadarshinaha. Not just that they see that everyone is a soul, but they see. You know, Krishna says, Matra sparsha stukante asitos na sukadukada agama paino nichastam satikshva sabharata. This tatikshava is not a kind of toleration. It's a full and complete acceptance that I fully accept that whatever comes to me is the mercy of the Lord. I mean, this attitude is particularly exemplified in Judd Bharat, I think, to a very extreme degree, where his stepbrothers give him old, worm-eaten food, and he accepts it. The dacoits are going to cut off his head in front of Kali. And he's very strong. And he's very powerful as a pure devotee. I mean, he could immediately burn them all to ashes. And he just accepts it. When he's forced into slavery to carry Rahugana's palanquin, he accepts it. The only reason he speaks to Rahugana is that he can recognize that Rahugana is a jnani, that Rahugana actually has some knowledge and he will be receptive. But even when he speaks to Rahugana, he says, you know, this is all nonsense you're speaking, but if you want me to carry your palanquin, I'll do it. If you want to think you're the king and I'm the servant and you want to order me, sure, I'll do that. Prahlad Maharaj, you want to try to kill me? Try to kill me. Haridas Thakur. He said, are you having some problem? They said, we've been beating you in 23 marketplaces and you haven't died. We're going to get punished. Our authorities, the political leaders will say, we didn't do our job. We'll get in trouble. He said, I don't want to cause you any trouble. And he went into a mystic trance, which appeared to be death. Like when Mahaprabhu went into a trance in the Jagannath temple, so many people thought he had died. And they threw him in the Ganga. They threw him in the Ganga because the Muslims said, he's left Islam, therefore he cannot be buried, and we don't want to give him a proper Hindu burial by cremating. So throw him in the Ganga. And then he came back to consciousness and came out of the Ganga. But a devotee has the mentality of never identifying a perpetrator. because they know that anything that happens to me can't be done by anybody other than God. If it could be, there wouldn't be fairness in the universe. If someone could hurt me in a way that I don't deserve and that's not good for me, then the whole universe would be unfair. If someone hurts me or does good to me, it must be because it's good for me, either by my karma or by Krishna's wisdom. Yes? The law of karma is also good for me, correct? The law of karma is to rectify me. So even if something's done according to my karma, so this morning I was hearing Prabhupada say that every child has the right to inherit the kingdom of God, just like every child has the right to inherit their father's property, that is the law. So for us to say we want to inherit the kingdom of God, that's natural. Prabhupada, as long as the acharyas say, as long as you stay alive, you will inherit. And what is that staying alive? It's not blaming or praising. The Shastric injunction is don't praise or criticize anyone. Of the two, more important not to criticize. But even undue praise. You have done this for me. I mean, we're supposed to be grateful. It's one of the 14 items of knowledge, is to be grateful. But we should understand that ultimately it's Krishna who's doing the good for us. It's not like Karna, where, you know, Duryodhan makes him the king of Anga, and so he says, okay, I'll die for you, or kill Arjuna. And so even when Kunti reveals that he's her son, even when Krishna reveals that he's Kunti's son, he says, no, I have to be grateful to Duryodhan. He's the source of my benediction. No, Krishna was the source of his benediction. So this is the view of the devotee. The view of the soul is that they're not interested in justice at all. You know, when people say everything has to be fair, my response is, if everything was fair, we would be suffering a lot. You know, we think, I want justice for those who hurt me, but none of us want justice for ourselves. Not one of us. We are very aware of how many times we do something that we shouldn't do. I think it's hard to go 24 hours and always live up to our own ideals in everything. Is that a fact? Has anyone here ever gone for a whole week where they always lived up to all their ideals in everything? Anybody? No. How many times have I thought something, said something, done something that is not even what I believe in? I'll say, this is what I believe. And 5 minutes later, I'm violating it. Yes? Whether it's eating too much or getting annoyed with somebody or not being as clean as we should be, whatever it is, whether it's a minor thing or some major thing, if we had to suffer reactions for all of that, whoa! And we read in the Shastra about these reactions. Yes? You ever read about these reactions? Oh my goodness. Even there's reactions if it's accidental. I've stepped on offered flowers and thought, oh no, what's going to happen to me? None of us want, I mean, seriously. But if somebody hurts us, oh yes, let them get every drop of what they're due. But for me, I'm saying, mercy, mercy, mercy. I had good intentions. I didn't realize it was accidental. I was weak. I was stupid. Yes? So the devotee is not interested in justice at all. And you know, in the spiritual world, there's no justice. There's no police force. There's no jails. there's just no justice. It's only mercy. That's all. Only mercy. And bhakti is only about mercy. Yastvindra gopamatavendra mahosul karma bandhanu rupa palabhajana matanati karma adi nirdhati kinituja bhakti bhaja. And it's an almost absolute mercy. Bhaktisiddhanta says, once you take initiation, if you don't follow through on your vows, you will not get the full result. But he also says that once you take initiation, even if you don't follow through, eventually you'll be delivered, except in very rare cases. It's a transcendental contract. Yamaraj says, you one time bow down before the Lord. Yamadutas are going to leave you alone. Lord Ramachandra says, someone surrenders unto me, I give them courage. Lord Nrisingadeva says, someone one time says, from this day on, Lord, I am yours. That person is my personal ward. That's just mercy. We call it causeless mercy. We don't deserve it. We can't deserve it. We deserve not to have it. And we get it anyway. We're all hoping to go back to Godhead at the end of this life. On what basis? That we're such pukka devotees. Does anyone here believe that they're such a pukka devotee that they deserve to go back to Godhead? Anybody? If you do, then that's a problem, actually. Because Rupa Goswami says, I've never done any sadhana. Rupa Goswami says, I've never done any sadhana. I've never done any devotional service. I've never done anything pious. Who of us is going to go before our guru, before Prabhupada, before the deities and say, I am a first-class pukka devotee. And therefore, I've earned my way back to God. This is all rubbish. The devotee thinks, I am the most sinful of all sinners. Whatever happens to me is a fraction of what I deserve. I'm begging for your mercy in spite of my sinfulness. Please pick me up. So the devotee, the soul, has zero interest in justice. Absolutely zero. In fact, they want to do good for those who hurt them. And Jesus talked about this. He says, if someone hits you on one side of your face, turn your face the other way and let them hit you on the other side. If they've asked for your shirt, give them your coat. He's talking about like in a court of law. If they forced you to walk 1 mile, walk 2. If someone curses you, bless them. If someone does bad to you, do good to them. And in so doing, be like your Father in heaven. And as devotees, this is our price. To enter the kingdom of God according to Lord Brahma. This attitude. Okay. But that's not what Krishna tells Arjuna to do. He tells Arjuna to have that mentality, but he doesn't tell Arjuna to simply say to all the other Kurus, it's okay. And nor does Parikshit. Parikshit actually tries to kill Kali. What's going on here? What's going on here is that in this world, we have duties to perform in Krishna's service according to our material nature. And this is called Varna Dharma. Krishna says, Chatur Varna Mayashristam. Guna karma vivagasa. And Krishna tells Arjuna at the same time, he says, don't have friends or enemies. If you're advanced, you see the friends, the enemies, the mediators, the neutral, the well-wisher, all with an equal mind. Now, will you get up and fight, please? Mam anusmram yujicha. Have this mood of thinking of me, this mood of equilibrium, and fight. And Prabhupada says he had to be angry to fight. Interesting. But we don't want to identify with our varna. We want to do our varna as a service. Yagyartat karmano natra loko yam parma bandana taratam karma kontaya mukta sangha samachara. If we have a brahmana varna, then we are going to act very much just like a Vaishnava in terms of being forgiving and not interested in justice. But if we have a kshatriya varna, then we are the ones who are the keepers of justice in the world. If we have a Vaishya dharma, then we're the ones who feed and clothe everybody. If we're the Sudra varna, then we're the ones who make society work. We're the ones who create a functional society, and we're the ones who create all the beauty in society. So I want to look briefly. I'm working on a book with a devotee named Rukmini, not my god sister Rukmini. Her legal name is Dr. Ruchira Dutta. So we're working on a book on career dharma. So I thought I'd take a little bit of time to bring out some of the points from this book about the principles of varna, to understand why Dharma the bull is acting in one way and Parikit the emperor is acting in another way, even though both Parikit and Dharma, as devotees, do not name the perpetrator. But why Dharma as a brahmana does not name the perpetrator externally, but Parikit as a kshatriya does. So the first principle of varna dharma is that we act according to our nature, guna and karma, that our livelihood should be according to our nature. Our nature means what we enjoy, what we're good at, what gives us a sense of accomplishment, what stretches our skills. And Krishna talks about what do the kshatriyas enjoy. Happy are the kshatriyas to whom such fighting opportunities come unsought, opening for them the doors of the heavenly kingdom. Kshatriya likes an opportunity to fight and kill an evildoer and identify an evildoer. Huh? Brahmana, Vaishya, Shudra, they don't like an opportunity to fight. They're like, oh no, there's a fight going on. So what do we enjoy? What are we good at? What can we master? And how do we enjoy that? We can understand that through the nature of the fields of work. So in the field of artistry, this is someone who enjoys creating beauty. Actually, those in the field of artistry create all the rasa in society. There'd be no rasa without the field of artistry. And as we said, all the functionality of society, all the physical needs of everyone are provided by those in the field of artistry. So one who likes that, one who likes their enjoyment is to work with things, to create function, to create beauty. Those who are in the field of resources, they expand wealth and profit. They direct the flow of raw materials from earth, water, fire, and plants and animals through harvestry to those who consume them. Those who are in the field of government, they protect from internal and external threats. They're energized by creating peace and order and care and justice and morals and ethics. Those in the field of ideas, they're energized by wisdom, guidance, truth, research, study, teaching, counseling, medicine. And if we look at the different temperaments of the fields, so in artistry, the enjoyment is, I made that. I created that. I cleaned that. I fixed that. A solid sense of using some sort of tool, or using one's body as a tool, like in dance, helping others. That, well, others are using what we do. Remember when I was in Russia and I was noticing these devotee artists and thinking they're painting all these paintings that go in other people's houses. That satisfaction, I'm creating something beautiful or functional that other people will enjoy. Even the people picking up the trash, they're thinking, I'm creating beauty in society. I'm creating function in society. Someone who's expert in this field wants authentic and honest service and takes satisfaction in the work itself. They're not so interested in name and fame. They're happy with having a family, a home, and helping others. They're happy with the simple things in life. Not going to be interested in a lot of hard work and expansion. And the main questions people in this field ask about their work, and everyone asks all these questions, but the main question someone in the field of artistry asked is it beautiful? Is it supportive? Then in the field of resources, these people enjoy working with land, crops, animals, money, natural resources. They have great ambitions. They're rarely satisfied. Bhagavatam says they're always thirsty, not literally like for water. They always want to expand, to take risks. They're very goal-oriented. The experts in this field are systems thinkers. They know the flows of the natural resources, and they can direct those flows not only for society, but for themselves. Because their main questions are is about their work, is it sustainable? Is it regenerative? Part of making it sustainable is they have to sustain themselves. They have to make sure there's a profit for themselves. Otherwise, it's not sustainable and regenerative. Then those who are in the field of government, their disposition is fairness and rules, morals and ethics. Everything has to be fair. Everything has to be balanced. They want to make people happy. They want to be a hero by taking care of people, protecting people, making sure everybody has everything that they need. They argue easily. They fight easily. They tend to be very courageous. They have a tough skin. They have a take charge mentality. An expert is very goal-oriented, decisive, determined. They're systems thinkers like those in the field of resources, but much bigger. They don't just see the systems of resources or a particular resource. They see the system of the whole society. They can direct the flows in human society. They're aware of emerging trends and needs. They can see the whole and the parts. They're resourceful, they're courageous, they're very generous. And their main questions about their work is it just? In other words, is it fair? And is it honorable? Then those in the field of ideas, they like to play with language or mathematics. They want to find truth. They're always looking for truth. They're very curious. They see the patterns in ideas, relationships, and systems. They may like to research or study or to teach. The experts in this field are peaceful, very forgiving, self-controlled, austere, pure, very tolerant, very honest, very knowledgeable, very wise, and very religious. They like to collect knowledge, understand it, use it, and share it. And their main questions about their work are, is it true? Is it wise? So what happens if a person works in another nature? Because that's a lot of the question that's coming up here. If Parikkhit were to have taken the same stance as the bull, he would have been working out of his nature. And Krishna is very clear in the Bhagavad Gita, you cannot repress your nature, it will come out anyway. And better to die doing your nature. If you follow another's path, it's very dangerous. Now, for everyone in all varnas, at the end of life, they should give up that identification and only act on the Vaishnava platform. In fact, the problem with Bharat Maharaj is he was already in Bhava in the forest and he saw this deer whose mother had died, and he switched back to his government position. I'm the protector of the weak and helpless. I can sacrifice my Vaishnava duties to do my government duties. Woo, bad idea. But what happens when people cross fields? Well, first of all, whenever anyone crosses fields, they will feel mentally very uncomfortable. Let's say, we'll look at each of these. Let's say someone in the field of resources works in government. They'll start caring about their special interests instead of the whole society. Do we see this happening? Mm-hmm. Right? Also, they'll be psychologically uncomfortable because their mood is not to care for people, their mood is to care for resources. They put the resources ahead of the people. All of a sudden, they've got to put the people ahead of the resources. You know, people talk about what should you put first, the project or the people. In the field of resources, you better put the project first. And in government, you better put the people first. And so someone who's naturally in the field of resources is going to have a hard time putting the people first. And he's going to think, well, that's not going to work. That's not going to work. Things won't be sustainable if I'm always putting the people first. Right? The government just gives to everybody. We read about these people in government in the Bhagavatam. They just give in charity indiscriminately, but the people in resources don't do that. They say, you've got to work for it. It's a different mood. What about people from the field of government working in resources? They don't care about profit. They don't care about sustainability. They just care about helping people. You'll see people make someone who belongs in the field of government, they go in the field of resources, they donate all the profits to charity, and the business fails. Because when you're in the field of government, you want to help people. You don't care about resources. You don't care about keeping the resources sustainable. Like, distribute everything to everybody. And then the project fails. When the project fails, people don't get the resources that they need. When people from the field of ideas work in the field of government, they'll be forgiving rather than giving justice. It's hard for them to be decisive quickly, and they may lose their sense of truth. I believe this is one of the biggest problems we have in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, that we have people who are by nature in the field of ideas, and we're putting them in positions where they're doing the work of government. And so they're not interested in justice and morals and ethics. They're interested in forgiving and tolerance. And it drives people bananas. It's like, where's the justice? Don't identify the perpetrator. Be forgiving. You know, that's fine. I mean, it puts someone in the field of ideas in great anxiety to have to punish people and get into justice and fairness. And they do a terrible job at it. If someone from the field of government goes into the field of ideas, then they will use knowledge for political purposes. They'll subvert knowledge. They'll also impose a hierarchical structure on the field of ideas. The field of ideas has to be very free-flowing. It can't have a rigid hierarchical structure, or it kills everything. But somebody from the field of government will want to impose this kind of a structure in the field of ideas. Or they'll misuse the flow of ideas. If someone from the field of ideas goes into the field of resources, they won't care about profit and resource flow. It doesn't interest them. They're like, this is stupid. Why should I want to make money? I'll just satisfy with whatever comes of its own accord. You know, and again, the whole thing fails. The farm falls apart. You know, I'll take care of a little patch. Why would I want to take care of 20 cows? This doesn't interest them. They think making a profit is dirty. Whereas for those in the field of resources, they see that making a profit is essential to keep the business sustainable and regenerative. If people from the field of resources go in the field of ideas, they will corrupt truth for profit. And we see this happens in journalism, when you blur the line between what's advertisement and what's journalism. You know, so as soon as someone goes in the field of someone from the field of resources goes in the field of ideas, they'll use research, they'll use ideas to promote a particular way of making money. When someone from the field of artistry goes into the field of government or ideas, they have a really hard time with the big picture. People in the field of artistry, they're into their own craft, their own skill. People in resources have a little bit bigger picture about their own flow of resources. Government, a bigger picture, looking at the needs of all the people in their domain. And the people in ideas have the biggest picture. They're seeing all the intricate patterns. And so when someone in the field of artistry goes into the field of government or into the field of ideas, they can't function in trying to see that big picture. It stresses them. They often end up imposing a bureaucratic system, not just a hierarchical system, but a bureaucratic system. They'll make government bureaucratic, or they'll make research bureaucratic. In fact, the bureaucrats who work in government are really people in the field of artistry who are assisting the government. But the government itself shouldn't be bureaucratic. The government should be like a family. When you have people from government or ideas work in artistry, they become insubordinate. If you're naturally in the field of government or in the field of ideas and you have to work in the field of artistry, you don't want to be told what to do. And you have to narrow this vision considerably, where you're not able to use your broad vision in your work. It's extremely frustrating. If someone from the field of resources works in the field of artistry, they automate everything for efficiency. People in the field of artistry are into the beauty and the sanctity of their craft. They want to pass their craft down through the generations. But people in the field of resources, they're interested in just moving those resources quickly and efficiently to maximize profit, so they automate everything. They make everything into a factory. They kill the soul of artistry. Someone from the field of artistry who goes into the field of resources, they don't know how to manage these flows, and they end up producing waste and inefficiency. So as soon as anybody crosses paths, when they cross from one field into another field, they create havoc in society and for their own psychology. They feel uncomfortable. Many times people take into intoxication is because they've crossed into the wrong field. And so they can't express their nature. Of course, Krishna says they express it anyway, but they just do it wrongly. In our Hare Krishna movement, and I taught ISKCON history for many years, I'm convinced that we have not activated people in the field of government. So in the beginning days of the movement, we only activated people in the field of ideas and artistry, and then only in very narrow occupations in those fields. And even today, in most of our ISKCON temples, there's a place for you if you have a few different occupations in the field of ideas and a few different occupations in the field of artistry, and that's about it. Starting in the late 80s, of course, we did encourage people in the field of resources if they wanted to take care of cows, but you know, or farm, but that was all on these collective farms where people really couldn't establish their own business and their own profit. We were having this kind of communistic situation. And people who are naturally in the field of resources, they can't function in that kind of a situation. It's putting them really, it's forcing them to be in the field of artistry rather than the field of resources. So we started in the late 80s and the 90s to encourage people in the field of resources because we needed money. And so we actually started encouraging people, make your own business, do something successful so that you can donate some money. But we haven't really fully understood how those people can act as devotees. And I see that we haven't activated people in the field of government almost at all. We just, when people have that nature as devotees, we just have not a clue as to how to engage them properly in ISKCON itself. And what they end up doing is trying to pretend that they're in the field of ideas or pretend that they're in the field of resources, which are the two fields next to them. And they end up causing havoc. I'm also convinced that a lot of the, not everybody, but a lot of the people who are perpetual critics of ISKCON are frustrated people in the field of government. Because our society is mostly run by people who are not in the field of government. That's just the truth. The people who are managing our society are mostly in the field of ideas, which means they're really bad at taking care of people's needs. They themselves are very simple and austere, and they don't know why does somebody need another blanket. It just doesn't compute to people in the field of ideas. You mean I have to make sure people have water and food and blankets and they get taken care of when they're sick, and it's just not their thing. And again, they're not into justice and morals and ethics. They're into liberation. They're just, you know, someone did a bad, oh, forgive them, it's okay. They're chanting Hare Krishna. You know, or these people or we have people in the field of resources, and they're putting the projects above people. They're not making, again, they're not making sure the people get taken care of. That's for the field of government. When you have people running ISKCON who are naturally in the field of resources, the temple's going to have a lot of money. The resources are going to flow, but people are going to be burned. They're going to be overworked. And they're going to use, I have to say, the philosophy as a way of making money. That's what they do. And if you have people in the field of artistry in positions of authority, they're going to make ISKCON in a centralized bureaucracy, which Prabhupada said would kill the whole thing. They're going to make ISKCON about more rules and more rules and more rules, and let's add some rules to that, and let's add some more rules to that as well. Oh, let's get on everybody's case all the time about all of the rules. And they're just not going to be able to see the big picture at all. They're not going to be able to take care of the flow of money. They're not going to be able to take care of the flow of people. And they're not even going to be able to take care of the flow of ideas. They may make sure the temple's very clean. So we don't really have... We have people of this kind who have this nature, many, many. But we don't engage them, actually, in this propensity. And so we have a real lack in our movement of taking care of people, what we call now devotee care. It's a real problem. It's not a small problem. And we have a big problem with justice and morals and ethics. Would you all agree? It's a really big problem. It's not a small problem. You know, we don't have a good justice system. We don't have a good due process system. Anybody can accuse anybody of anything. And just the fact that you're accused may immediately be found guilty because we don't have a justice system. Or nothing may happen to you even if you're actually found guilty by some sort of partial due process system. You know, we harshly punish people who are not even guilty. We let go of people who are actually guilty. It's a mess. It's a mess. And if somebody accuses you, you know, may you never be accused of anything. But I'll tell you, if somebody accuses you of someone you love or someone you love, you'll immediately see that our due justice process stinks. Or if somebody's hurt you, you'll see it. It's terrible. It's a terrible process. We're trying, you know, but it doesn't work very well. And so the people who have this mentality, they're all, and now that we have the internet, they're all over the internet. This justice wasn't done, and this fairness wasn't done, and this... Name that perpetrator! You know, that's kind of their motto. Name the perpetrator! Punish the perpetrator! And so when you read verses like this, these people who are naturally in government become very angry. So how do we deal with this? Well, first of all, we're all supposed to become Vaishnavas and act on the platform of soul, which means we don't name perpetrators or punish perpetrators in our heart, ever. If our mind goes to that place, we say, oops, materialistic thinking. Maharaj Prithu says those who try to counteract reverses enter into the darkest region of materialistic thought. We accept reverses as Krishna's kindness, and we don't try to punish or blame other people for our reverses, even if apparently they are the source. Just like we don't sell our soul to those who are our benefactors, like Karna did. Either way is wrong. At the same time, we should be aware, what kind of nature do I have in this world? And as long as I'm in this world, especially if I'm in the grihastha ashram, where I have to act according to my varna, then if I'm in the field of government, I'd better name perpetrators and punish them and have due process. That's my job. And if I'm not in the field of government, I should respect those who are and facilitate them doing that job, even if I myself can't personally relate to that. And I should remember that every occupation has its fault, like smoke covers fire. There's always some fault. There's nothing perfect in this world. And whatever job we're doing, we do for the glory of God. We do to please Krishna. We do to please Prabhupada. We do to have a sane and stable society. And that ultimately, for all of us, sarvapati vinirvimuktam tat paratena nirmala rishikesha rishikena sevita bhakti vijita. All of us internally needs to give up all of these labels. I am not a Brahmin, I'm not a Kshatriya, I'm not a Vaishya, I'm not a Shudra, I'm not a Brahmacharya, I'm not a Grihastha, I'm not a Vanaprastha, I'm a Sannyasi, I'm a servant of the servant of the servant of the servant of the Lord of the Gopis. And that's all. But if I have a particular kind of a vehicle in this world, then I have to drive that vehicle for Krishna. If I have a bicycle, I can't pretend it's a boat. If I have a boat, I can't pretend it's a plane. And I have a job to do for Krishna. But even the devotees doing these jobs, and even if they may have to, as Prabhupada said, Arjuna, Hanuman, they had to feel anger, it wasn't Rajagun. It was a rasa of anger. But even then, all throughout the Bhagavatam, what do all the kshatriyas do at a certain point? They all retire. Every one of them. And they do it as fast as they can.
They do not stay on the position until the end of their life.
They do not stay on that position to the end of their life. Of course, if they die on the battlefield, that's also auspicious. But as soon as they have a successor, they leave. And they're very fixed on having a successor. That's why all these kshatriyas want to have a child. Mm-hmm. Do you wonder why the Bhagavatam is full of all these kings that, you know, I have to have a son. That's their ticket to go. All right, put my son in charge. I'm out of here. I'm going to act as a Vaishnava. I'm not going to act in this way anymore. So even as a Brahmana, one gives up. So at a certain point, we give it up. It's not just at a certain point we give up family life in terms of sex and money, but at a certain point we give up identifying with a particular varna. And we don't do this anymore. There's a nice story in the Ramayana. So Ram and Lakshman's teacher going through the forest, and you know, they're carrying bows. They're wearing bark or deerskin with matted hair. But they're carrying bows. They carried their bows and arrows into the forest, which caused one demon. That demon was one of the first demons they encountered. What was his name? Caused him to criticize them. He says, "What is this? Two men dressed as ascetics with matted hair and bark, carrying bows and arrows and traveling with a woman. What is this? Hypocrites." Anyway, Ram and Lakshman, of course that guy was killed. Anyway, Ram and Lakshman, they're meeting with the sages. And the sages said, "Pahima, Pahima, protect us, protect us. The Rakshasas are eating us and spoiling our yajnas." And then Ram says, "Yes, I will protect you." And so Sita says to him, "You know, my lord, it's not my place to instruct you, but it seems to me that we're living in the forest. We're not living in the palace. Bharat is the king. Why are you doing the duties of a kshatriya?" And Ram says, "No, this exile is not vanaprastha. I haven't finished my grihastha life. I'm still a kshatriya. This is simply to fulfill my father's promise. And anyway," he said, "technically I'm the king and Bharat is my assistant. My shoes are on the throne." So this mood that if you're in that position, then you have to protect, you have to identify the perpetrator, and you have to mete out justice. And there's this balance between cultivating our mentality as a devotee and externally acting in the world according to our nature, which, as Prabhupada says in 9:30, sometimes parallel each other, and sometimes come into opposition with each other. And he says, when Krishna is talking about abhijat sucharacharo, even if a devotee does something abominable, what that generally means is that, the way Prabhupada explains it in that purport, is that we have some duty according to our material nature, our material duty, that is somehow not in harmony with our spiritual duties. And so we will appear to do something abominable. I always think of, when I read that purport, how I disobeyed my mother to join the Hare Krishna movement. By Vedic standards, disobeying your mother is abominable. But in order to join the Hare Krishna movement, I did that. Or it may be the other way, that even though a devotee is always forgiving and tolerant and doesn't identify the perpetrator, if you're Arjuna on the battlefield, that's what you have to do. You can't just say, "Well, I don't know who's on the Pandava side and who's on the Kuru side, because I'm not identifying the perpetrator." You got to know. And Arjuna was bewildered about this. He said, you told me keep abominable activities far distant, and yet you're asking me to fight. So sometimes there is a conflict. Sometimes we have to act externally in the world in Krishna's service in a way that appears contrary to Vaishnava principles. And sometimes in order to follow our Vaishnava principles, we have to act in a way that appears contrary to our duties in the world. But if we do everything for the glory of Guru and Krishna, and we surrender to Krishna, then we're still considered saintly, and one shouldn't be judged harshly by these external conflicts. So this is a very big topic. We could talk about this, I'm sure, until 9 o'clock tonight or 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, and we still wouldn't have explored all the finer details of this. But like Prabhupada said, catch the big fish, but don't get wet. Somehow we need to be in the world where all of our duties have some fault. All of our duties in the world have some fault. All of our duties in the world have some fault. And to maintain our inner consciousness as a Vaishnava, and therefore be unaffected, like the lotus leaf is untouched by water. Questions, comments, chastisements?
Thank you very much for this class. I'm not saying this, just like you usually say, but because I really feel about it, and this is something what personally, I don't know, because of nature or whatever experience, I was thinking a lot connected to our society, the National Society for Christian Consciousness. It's actually also experience of being a part of a big society, the place where I work, and these principles are working, otherwise and I think that this book, what you are writing together with the Rukmini Mataji and so on, I personally see it as something completely necessary for ISKCON even to be sustainable and to survive, to have these principles. So thank you so much for talking about it, though it cannot be told in 20 minutes. And also, if it cannot be understood by us in 20 minutes, I think it should be much more discussed and so on. I personally sometimes felt very much frustrated because these principles do not work in the society, and I see them.
Yes.
It's really frustrating. Yeah. Because people do not understand. They are one position, and they see everything from their own position.
But yes.
When they change position, they still act as this.
Yes. Yes, yes. Atmavan manyate jagat. We only see things according to our own position. Yes.
And I would have one question from the beginning, or from the Prabhupada's purport, where he himself says, it is the last sentence, I don't know exactly this English word, but it's something like, the one who pinpoints the sins of other person is also sinful as himself, and
yes.
Attains the same destination.
Well, that is the verse itself.
Yes.
The verse itself is that if you point out someone else's sins, you get the same destination as the sinner.
About this. And Srila Prabhupada explains this also. He strengthens it in the
purport, yes.
But he himself was the one who's pointed out many mistakes, many fails, many sinfulness of the society, of the people, different people. You can read everything.
Yes.
You can even find calling them, living as, calling us, living as cats and dogs and so on. So
yes.
He was the one who was really pinpointing, he was, let's say, fault finders. He found the real faults.
Yes.
I find it everything correct what he said, but this, according to this verse and his commentary, it would say that he would meet the same destiny, but I don't think it would be like that.
Oh, I'm so glad that you said this. I always like it when devotees ask questions like that without fear that somebody will think, oh, you're criticizing Prabhupada, that we can actually surface these sort of questions. So the Vedic instruction is you don't praise and you don't criticize. But when you are a teacher, when you are an acharya, you must say what's good and what's bad. On a material level, it's one of the duties. It's interesting because let's just look at it on a material level in terms of varna. In the field of ideas is especially where a person is very forgiving and very tolerant and where they actually don't blame or identify perpetrators. But it's also in the field of ideas where you have to establish what is right and what is wrong. The people in the field of ideas are guiding all the other fields. The people in the field of government, if they're going to punish wrongdoers, it's in the field of ideas that you define what is a wrongdoer. So those definitions must come from the people in the field of ideas. They have to. And of course, on an external level, Srila Prabhupada is taking that role of a teacher, of an acharya. You must do that. Even on a simple level, you have to say this is good grammar and this is bad grammar. If you're a teacher of grammar, you can't just say it's all good. That's ridiculous. You know, that the codes of religion are actually coming from the field of ideas, from the very people who don't identify the perpetrator. So in the field of ideas, you don't blame anybody, because part of what you're presenting is that everything is being done by God and everything's being done by karma, and then blaming somebody puts yourself in the same position of basically envy. So that's your responsibility as a teacher. But what we saw with Srila Prabhupada, who not only was acting externally like that as a teacher, but is also a Nityasiddha devotee, a pure devotee of the Lord, is that Prabhupada never had any envy or malice. And I understand that the reason why identifying the perpetrator makes you also sinful is it puts you in a mood of envy and malice. It puts you in a mood of wanting to hurt somebody, which is exactly what the perpetrator did, and therefore you're the same. The perpetrator hurts somebody. You say, I want to hurt the perpetrator. Then you're the same. Like you were saying yesterday, if you find fault in the fault finder, you are also a fault finder. Let the criminal suffer. You want somebody to suffer. They wanted someone to suffer. You're the same. The thief wanted you to suffer so he or she could get money at your expense. And you want the criminal to suffer so you can feel happy at their suffering. It's the same thing. The criminal wants to feel happy at your suffering. And if you want them to be named and punished, you want to feel happy at their suffering. It's the same. Exactly the same. And Prabhupada never had that mood. Prabhupada never took pleasure in others' suffering. And in fact, the Vaishnava who's in the field of government doesn't have that mood either. It's just superficial that he punishes sinful people. He enjoys a good fight. But he'd rather that they could get rectified. Therefore, when Kali surrendered, Prakrit doesn't kill him anyway. It's not that he wants to punish him. He wants him to be rectified.
I think it was a mistake.
Huh? You think Parikit made a mistake? You want to talk to him about that? you can have a discussion about that. No, but he knew. He knew that there's a reason for the age of Kali. He saw that it was that there's a reason for winter. Winter has a place. In areas where there's no winter, there's a lot more problems with insects and diseases. Everybody knows the tropical areas have more diseases. Why? They don't get killed in the winter. You know, there's a place for sleep. There's a place for rest. And there has to be a place for Kali Yuga. Otherwise, how would the jivas who are not qualified to be humans become humans? Every jiva has to get a chance to be a human. But what do? There's all these jivas, they don't deserve to be humans. They only deserve to be animals. When do they get a chance to be humans? So you have to have a time when only animal-like humans are humans. It would be very disturbing if jivas who weren't qualified to be humans were going around in Satyayuga, they'd ruin everything. So there's a place. There's a reason why there's a cosmic winter. There's a reason why there's a Kali Yuga. And Pariksit knew that. He knew there's a time for this. Like when you have a school with children, sometimes you say, break time! And they go outside and they run around and scream. Yes? Right? Has to be. You can't keep the children in class all the time. If you keep the children in class all the time, they'll start having a break time in the class. I probably said not more than 45, 50 minutes. Then you say, you tell them, run and scream. Now go run and scream. That's your job right now. So there has to be some time for that. And Pariksit, he acknowledged that. But I mean, when the first time we met with Prabhupada, and Prabhupada understood that my father was my father, and he started telling the story of Prahlad and Hiranyakashipu, he was calling my father a demon. And my father wasn't insulted. Ravindasu Prabhu tells the same story, how Prabhupada called his father a fool and a materialist, and his father wasn't offended. Because Prabhupada had no malice. He had no envy. He only wanted good for others. So the unfortunate thing is when we who are not on that platform read or hear these statements from Prabhupada and we take it as an excuse for Rajagun and Tamagun. All those hogs, dogs, camels, and asses. All the two-legged animals. We don't understand. Prabhupada's speaking from a position of compassion. And love. Not from a position of condemnation and punishment at all. It's just not. I mean, sometimes Prabhupada would say heavy things. Like you say, anyone who beats the children should be hanged. You know, there were certain things where Prabhupada was really like, that cannot be tolerated. Prabhupada never knew that there were people who raped children and molested them. He was never informed of anything like that. I don't know what he would have said, but it probably wouldn't have been very pretty. But, you know, we take these statements from Prabhupada and our acharyas and think, oh, great, you know, I can go out with my machete. And we take it completely the wrong way. And we see that Srila Prabhupada was... I mean, the only devotees that he threw out of the movement were four sannyasis who preached that he was God. And eventually he let them back. And the only disciples he renounced were these two disciples who renounced him and said they just wanted to enjoy the material world. And he said, then you have my blessings, go and enjoy. Even one Sanskrit scholar who ended up by bad association criticizing Bhaktisiddhanta very severely, Prabhupada said, he will attain prema in 10,000 births. He didn't say never. He said he'll attain prema in 10,000 births. And Prabhupada was extremely forgiving and tolerant of people who broke, you know, morals and ethics and the regulative principles. Extremely. I was just reading a letter where Prabhupada was criticizing these two devotees who stole money from a temple and left with it. And he wrote that in 73. And I know very well that in 74, he was dealing with one of those devotees again in a completely different mode. And just encouraging him in Krishna consciousness. I mean, I know that. I mean, I was there when, you know, there was a temple president who wasn't chanting his rounds, wasn't going to the morning program. And so the devotees threw him out of being temple president. Prabhupada reinstated him. He didn't stay. I mean, he ended up leaving anyway. But Prabhupada put him right back. I mean, I was there. It was kind of awkward because the new temple president was the one who invited our family to that temple. So we moved there under the invitation of the new temple president. And as soon as Prabhupada heard that the old temple president had been kicked out, he put him back in his position. And the old temple president said, I didn't invite you. So it was kind of awkward. Our family was put in a very awkward situation by this. So I'm intimately familiar with what happened. And I know of another instance where, you know, a devotee wasn't following, and as the temple president, the devotees kicked him out, and Prabhupada again immediately just put him back. He did that. I mean, in a case where, there was a case where one sannyasi had an illicit affair with a woman like 20 years older than him. And Prabhupada conducted the wedding. There's even photographs of Prabhupada conducting the wedding. And he said, I didn't want him to be with this woman. I didn't want him to get married. But he conducted the wedding, initiated the woman. But then this woman was beating, literally physically beating the Brahmacharinis in the temple. They were taking the Sankirtan collections and using it to buy their own retreat. And she was going in the deity kitchen. She was just first initiated. She was going in the deity kitchen and cooking with eggs and chicken and offering it to the Radhakrishna deities. And she was going on the altar, although she only had first initiation, she was going on the altar and she'd get saris to match the deity's outfits for herself. So she'd be wearing something matching the deity's outfits and offering arti to the deities. And when these people were kicked out, Prabhupada was very happy. Happy that they were thrown out. And I know that because I ended up in Gopal Krishna Maharaj when he was Grihastha. I ended up in Gopal Krishna's apartment. I got his apartment, and he had kept all the letters, copies of all the letters to Prabhupada and copies of the letters from Prabhupada about that situation. So in a situation like that, people were offering chicken and eggs to the deities. They were beating the other devotees. And Prabhupada was very pleased that the devotees had thrown them out of the temple. And he did not reinstate them. So, there's those situations. But, what? It's very extreme. And we have another situation where a devotee had left and wasn't following any of the four principles, not even vegetarianism, came to see Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada engaged him in cooking for him. But he had just done that on his own. He hadn't polluted a temple. He didn't pollute a temple. He wasn't like cooking meat in the temple. You know, he just outside. And Prabhupada, he said, you come and you cook for me. So even though Prabhupada said very heavy things about people doing sinful activities or materialistic activities, his mode of dealing with people was always Vaishnava. Always. It was always at this highest Vaishnava platform. All the time. Just consistently. You know, just always. He just did not act in another way. The only time he threw people out was when they said he was God. Which he took as a, you know, offense to Krishna. It was the only time. And then he did welcome them back after that, when they rectified. So, there it is. What did Jesus say? Hate the sin and not the sinner. And we need to have Kshatriyas in our movement who are managing things and having justice and morals and ethics. But they have to be Vaishnavas too. They have to be Rajarishis. Not just some Rajagun Kshatriya. That's going to cause just as much trouble as not having any. It's just going to cause another kind of trouble. You know, we can't have gun-happy, sword-happy leaders. And therefore, the people in the field of ideas always have to be guiding the people in the field of government. So the people who are forgiving and tolerant, they have to be giving the guidance and keep this tendency such that it doesn't go too far in any one direction. I know the sociologist Burke Rochford once asked me, you know, what do we put more weight on, like statements in the Shastra where Prabhupada did, and quoting, you know, Mahajanayana, Vitasapanta, that our main thing is, what did the Mahajanas do? That just using, you know, logic, just using Tarka, or even Shrutayo Bibhina, that there will be different things in the Shastra, and then different things according to logic, but we have to see, what did the great personalities do? What did the Acharyas do? Even what did the Kshatriyas do? I mean, another nice example, we have Parikit here, who's ready to kill Kali, but he tolerated Sringi. Not just tolerated, he accepted. Another nice example is Ambarish. So when Durvasa Muni is trying to kill him, for what? Drinking water? Fulfilling his vow? What is he trying to kill him for? I mean, Durvasa was completely in the wrong there. 100%. And Ambarish just stands there with folded hands. You're a Brahmana, you're my guest, you want to kill me? You kill me. Now believe me, if that was an enemy on the battlefield, Ambarish was a Kshatriya. He wouldn't have stood there with folded hands, you kill me, you kill me. He would have taken up his weapons and fought. But for his own sake, I accept it as Krishna. I'm not going to counter this. Is that okay? Anyway, somehow we need to do. May I have? I probably told one of my god sisters who was asking about taking care of her children and doing service. And he said, you must have some common sense and do not do one thing at the expense of another. And he said, just like the woman is doing so many things, but she doesn't forget to take care of her bunch of hair. So no matter what services you're doing, you have to also take care of your children. No matter how you're taking care of your children, you also have to take care of doing some service. So we have our duties on the external platform, and then we have our mentality as Vaishnavas. We don't get caught up so much in our externals that we forget that we're Vaishnavas, and we don't get caught up so much in an otherworldly sense that we forget that we have some duties in the world. And I think Prabhupada really exemplified this for us. Anyway, I'm sure there's 1,000 more questions and 1,000 more permutations than what
is. It's not black and white.
No, it's not. It's not, which is why you need people in the field of ideas at the ultimate head of the society. Because it's only people in the field of ideas that can think in a nuanced way. They're the ones who see all the patterns in the system. And, you know, people in the field of artistry are the least capable of that. That's why if they go into the field of ideas or government, they become bureaucrats. And they just try, this is the rule, and this is the rule, and this is the rule, and this is the consequence. And they ruin everything. Dharma is not some sort of static black and white thing. It's a living system. It's something organic. Like with Aswatthama, you know, how do you kill him and not kill him? And it's, you know, you have to be able, and Arjuna really struggled with this in the Bhagavad Gita. He kept going to this black and white thinking. That how can you tell me to fight and do Buddha yoga? It's incompatible. You know, he just couldn't put the two of them together. And yeah, we absolutely must train. I mean, one of the things we're working on in the Shastric Advisory Council is a system of hermeneutics. How to understand Shastra and the Acharyas. And we absolutely must train. Just because people have an inclination to be in the field of ideas, they still have to get training. Like Arjuna needed training to shoot his bow and arrow. We have to train people how to function in the field of ideas to govern society. You know, I've been focusing how we have to have people in the field of government, but we also have to have people in the field of ideas. Otherwise, it's all spoiled. And frankly, people in the other fields, they cannot understand these things. They just can't. You know, it's just not their capability. We cannot get the mentality of another field. You know, you take someone in the field of ideas, put them in the running a business, they'll ruin it. They'll just ruin it. They're like, I got to look at the accounting. Why do I have to look at the accounting? I'm sure it's okay. Yeah. I'm sure you spend the money for Krishna at school. Oh, you take this. You can just have it. And they'll give everything away. And they won't care. So, this is the problem. That what's necessary in one field doesn't make any sense to people in other fields. And so the nuances of Dharma don't make sense to people in the other fields. They can't fathom it. And therefore there has to be some submission, which is really lacking in modern society. Everybody thinks that they know everything. Everybody thinks they're an expert in everything. They think they watch something on YouTube or they Google and then they know everything. But we don't. And people should be trained according to their position and then trust that other people are the experts in their field.
Long ago, I was asking Purnachandra. I think that time was Prabhupada, so it was Maharaj. And I asked him...
I don't understand almost anything. Neću se dobro i matri jako brzo govori, ja primarno slabo razumijem, da nije gotovo ništa ne razumijem.
You're saying we should have translation?
She said, no, they do not understand and they don't hear because of the noise. Then you speak fast, you are a native speaker.
I'm sorry, I've been trying to speak very slowly.
And I was asking the same question before, many years ago, and asked, why do you not have some training for kshatriyas? Because, in our society we need. And he said Prabhupada was very short here, and for him was mission establish a brahmanical culture, because brahmana can teach everyone else, but now they start something, martial arts and Gurukul, he said to me, and the managements we have.
Yes, we are starting. Course.
But he also told me, you must know that kshatriya is very rare. Kshatriya must be ready to cut somebody's neck. And this is really kshatriya. And we cannot find them so easily in this world. Just like this, he explained me many years ago. Now he's not more present with us. But I can see that now he's changing something. Like I said, Kauteya Prabhu show us how now GBC have some teaching for the next generation GBCs. Even we can go in this school.
Yes, I have taught there.
We can be GBC, but we can learn something.
Yes, well, gradually we will do this, and I will tell you very honestly, we do have many members of ISKCON who are Kshatriya by nature. We do. And it's not only throat cutters. Okay? It's not that every kshatriya is in the military. There are also people who work in government, in law. Lawyers are also in the field of government. People in the legislature are in the field of government. So field of government is not only the police, the firefighter, and the military. It's not only. The field is broader than that. It's like in the field of ideas, not everybody is a teacher. Some people are pujaris, some people are cooks, some people are researchers, some people are doctors, some people are journalists. So each field is very broad, and there are many people in the field of government. You can have the Secretary of State, the Secretary of the Interior, the Secretary of Education. These are all people in the field of government, and they don't go around with swords cutting off people's heads. But we definitely have people in our movement who are, we have many devotees who go into the military, and they want to go into the military, or they want to become police officers. I know many. And happy are such kshatriyas to whom fighting opportunities come unsought, opening for them the doors of the heavenly kingdom. They would not mind fighting with somebody at all. Not at all. They would think it was a wonderful opportunity. If they got to kill a bad guy, they would say, yes, I got to kill a bad guy. Like I say, yes, I get to research something in Shastra. Same. That's my candy. You follow?
Yep.
When I was asked by Harikesh to do research for an ISKCON encyclopedia, I felt I had died and gone to heaven. Wow, I get to research for an encyclopedia on Krishna consciousness. And the warrior said, I get to kill a criminal. But some people in government, it's like, I get to take care of millions of people. I get to make sure people have schools and hospitals and roads and clothes that they're taken care of. I get to take care of so many people. You know, most of us are like, okay, one child, two children, maybe three, maybe four. Somebody in government, they're like, give me millions. I'll take care of all of them. Yes. You ask me, take care of, 30 people. I'm like, really? I have to take care of 30 people? Seriously? Why? Can't somebody else do that? And then the people in the field of resources are like, we're going to give everybody ghee. And we're going to give everybody cotton. And I'm going to get rich too. We're going to make sure that the earth is taken care of and the rivers are taken care of. And we're going to take that so that people have food to eat and they have clothes to wear. And we're just going to make everything abundant and more abundant and more abundant. And everybody's going to be prosperous, and I'm going to be prosperous too. And then the people in the field of artistry, they're thinking, oh, look at what a beautiful thing I did. It works. I put the screen in the window. Look at that. There's no buggies coming in. It's perfect. Wow. What an opportunity I got. Oh, your plumbing's broken? Yes! I can get my tools and fix it for you. So, everybody has their candy. We all have our things. We're going, wow, an opportunity to use my skill set. It's just there. But anyway, yeah, we need to do this training. I see that one of the main things we need to do in ISKCON, we need to train everybody in bhakti how to be a Vaishnava, how to chant japa, how to chant in the kirtan, how to worship the deity, how to offer your food, very nice. Now we had better also teach people how to make your livelihood in the world according to the principles of Shastra, and how to form a society. That's a big job of ours that we're not doing so well. We're starting. We're making some steps to do that. But yeah, that is something that we're doing and we need to be doing. I see as one of the... Yes, isn't that one of the first purpose of ISKCON? To teach the techniques of spiritual life systematically to society at large. One of the techniques of spiritual life is how to understand what my nature is and how to use that in Krishna's service. Yes? Was I slower now? I tried to slow down again. Okay, we should really go because the prasadam is waiting. And no matter who and what we are, we all like to take prasadam. Srila Prabhupada ki.